You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out this week. Coming up, our next guest says our fashion choices are almost magic in the way they can reveal things we never knew about ourselves. We talked to a former New York Times fashion writer. First, if you're a parent, summer can be a whirlwind of activities in order to keep kids busy. And there are a lot of arguments for that. Kids who are busy tend to stay out of trouble and can learn a lot from those enrichment activities and can also avoid being bored. But some learning advocates say that parents should actually take a hard look at being bored and consider letting their children come up with their own activities in order to learn self-reliance. Joining us now to talk about the benefits of boredom is Teresa Belton. She's a visiting fellow at the School of Education and Lifelong Learning at the University of East Anglia. Teresa, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
So summer is upon us, and this is a time when a lot of parents feel compelled to book a lot of camps and enrichment activities and opportunities, things to keep their kids occupied during the summer. Yeah. And you're saying maybe they're going overboard and there's actually benefits to having bored kids over the summer. Why do you say that?
Well, I wouldn't say there are benefits to boredom as such, but there are benefits to not being constantly occupied or not constantly having activities and entertainments presented you as a child. There's a great benefit in learning to occupy oneself, to look around and find opportunities for letting the mind wander, letting it think of things to do. So boredom can be a great spur to trying new things. And so in that sense, boredom is a good thing, but obviously too much boredom isn't a good thing. But we do sometimes confuse, I think, boredom with not having anything very obvious to do at any particular time. And life these days is so full and pressured and frenetic that it can feel quite unfamiliar and uncomfortable to find oneself with unallocated time.
Is there science that shows that children benefit from having less structured time?
Well, I don't know about science, but I think there's plenty of anecdotal evidence, yes. My own research has, and I haven't actually researched boredom as such. I've come to it from the other way around. My research was into the influence of television and videos on children's story making quite a long time ago, before children had access to computers and did mobile digital technology. And the conclusion I drew, like researchers before me who'd looked at other aspects of the influence of television on children's imagination, that actually spending time in front of a screen isn't very good for the imagination, but having free time to fill themselves was good for the imagination. And then I took the research further and talked to some adults who are known in Britain for their creative work in different fields, who were talking about how boredom had been actually a great stimulus to them as children and still was and was important for their creativity. So I've come at it from that side rather than from looking at boredom as such.
Well, you said there is a limit, that too much boredom is not necessarily a good thing. So where's the middle ground? How do parents know that they're giving their children the productive, the fertile kind of downtime and boredom?
Well, I don't think it's something you can measure as such. I think that children do need to have... They need to develop inner resources of imagination and patience and perseverance, but also they need to have the sort of external resources, not only of free time itself, but also to have a certain amount of space. And, of course, some children have a lot more space than others according to their particular living conditions and the location where they are. But they also need to have the opportunity to make a mess, as long as they also then learn to clear it up, obviously. But I think a lot of people in the contemporary world are very kind of house proud and keen to keep things very clean and neat and tidy. But actually, that's not very helpful in children being able to pursue their own ideas and activities and occupations. They and adults, you know, need to have scope for messing around and trying things out and experimenting. And that also means not giving children masses and masses of specially designed toys and expensive specialized equipment, which I think is the tendency these days, but to realize that often one can be much more ingenious with simple materials that are versatile and lend themselves to be used in lots of different ways, whereas most purpose-designed toys and equipment are designed to be used in very specific ways, which actually limit what can be done with them. And, of course, another aspect to the way we live now is that we live in a very consumerist culture in the States and in much of Europe, and we're used to spare time, like many other aspects of life, being commodified. So there are lots of people looking to make money out of every situation, and so I think this is one of several reasons why there's a tendency to try and to fill up children's time with the ready-produced activities and entertainments, because they're being marketed to us all the time. And it's very easy as a parent to feel, on the one hand, pressurized into providing these, and on the other hand, guilty if you don't. But I think we all need to step back, I mean, in a parental role, but also for ourselves, and say, no, I'm going to resist all the commercial pressures for me to buy stuff and to buy activities and entertainments, and to look at, you know, what we ourselves can produce in the way of activities and satisfying occupations.
And we're talking now to Teresa Belton. She's a visiting fellow at the School of Education and Lifelong Learning at the University of East Anglia. And we're talking about the value of downtime, unstructured time, even boredom for children to a certain extent, and how that can foster creativity. And what would you say to convince parents that not only should their children have this extra downtime to come up with things to create, but they should be able to make a little bit of a mess doing it? That's swimming against the tide in some respects, where we're in this hyper-programmed era of parenting. What would you say to parents about that?
Well, I think I'd say, well, do you want to have children who grow up to be independent and have thoughts of their own, or do you want your children to grow up to be dependent on things being provided for them all the time and not having to think for themselves? I mean, I think, you know, if most people think about it, they would probably prefer to have children who have their own ideas, who can use their initiative, than children who are constantly demanding and expecting things to be provided for them.
And as far as adults, is there any kind of corollary here for grown-ups, too? Is it too late for us to benefit from downtime and boredom?
Oh, it's never too late, no. I mean, I think an awful lot of us adults probably have had so little downtime in the last few years that if we have it, it feels uncomfortable and we don't know what to do with it. But I think that is something that we need to relearn and regain, because our well-being requires that we have downtime, time to watch the world go by, time to reflect on our experience, time to feel that there aren't any pressures on us, if we possibly can. I mean, there are people, unfortunately, who will always feel pressures of one kind or another, but I think we need to try and work towards a situation in which we can actually sit back and enjoy life and take note of the world around us, whether it's the natural world or our fellow humans, and savor that and really get the most out of the little things in life, because they're much more satisfying than constantly worrying about keeping up with the neighbors or what the next thing is we're going to buy.
Teresa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you very much.
Teresa Belton is a visiting fellow at the School of Education and Lifelong Learning at the University of East Anglia. She joined us to talk about boredom and why it may be beneficial for children to be bored. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, the Juno probe entered Jupiter's orbit last night, an accomplishment the mission's principal investigator says is the hardest thing NASA has ever done. We'll find out what we can learn coming up. First, our next guest believes in fashion determinism, the idea that you can dress for the life you want to live even before you're actually that super cool person living that super cool life. And what's more, she says our clothes reveal more than we ever dreamed about who we are, how much money we make, and what we think about ourselves. Cintra Wilson is a former New York Times fashion writer. She explored the United States through its fashion choices and wrote about it in a new book called Fear and Clothing, Unbuckling American Style. Cintra, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. What are you wearing?
Hey, I was going to ask you that. I'm wearing Midwestern garb. I guess, a t-shirt, black slacks, sandals. I don't know. What do you make of that?
That sounds pretty good. It sounds better than what I'm wearing at the moment.
What are you wearing?
I'm wearing a very old t-shirt that says Quixote 51, as if Don Quixote was on a sports team, and some terrible shorts because I'm in a very hot house in Rhode Island. But that says absolutely nothing about me.
Well, I want to ask you about a line for your book that really caught my eye. You wrote that when used consciously, fashion is almost magic in its ability to reveal you to yourself and empower you. And that's a cool way to think about clothes, but what do you mean when you say fashion can reveal you to yourself?
Well, I think that the more permission that people give themselves to actually explore areas of fashion that they might be, that they're attracted to, but maybe too timid to indulge. I think that the more that you indulge yourself in these areas of excitement and interest, the more it reveals about your deep inner person. And I think it's very good exercise for you in terms of knowing who you are to actually indulge these fashion choices.
Why is it good for us?
Well, I think that people tend to become very locked down and very narrow in their fashion choices, particularly as they get older. But fashionistas are really not about what labels you wear or, how much money you spend. It's really more about people who have a very articulated and very personal sense of style that they allow themselves to explore.
Well, it's interesting because you say it's okay to wear all this stuff on the outside, but you also say that even if we're trying not to reveal who we are, that you can read things about us based on what we're wearing and reveal quite a lot. It says that you can just tell what kind of job we have, maybe our self-esteem. Why can you read so much based on what people are wearing?
Well, I think everybody does in a microsecond, really. I mean, first impressions are very important, and I think that we do take in a remarkable amount of information at first glance from people. I mean, we look at their shoes and we look at their pants, and we think we know a lot about people based on their presentation, because the way you get dressed in the morning is really kind of your fashion statement for the day, and your statement can involve things that you deliberately choose or that are sort of default statements about who you've become. And it can be either, you can either grow yourself or limit yourself in this regard. And I think that there's sort of a gentleman's agreement to not notice as much as we do about each other's fashion. It's kind of impolite to notice, but I think it's something that we all evaluate every day.
And you went around the country kind of taking stock of the different way people dressed, maybe trying to read the tea leaves about what it said about who they were. And one of the places you went, you didn't come to Wisconsin, but you did go to the Iowa State Fair. And to be fair, the Iowa State Fair is probably more like the Midwest on steroids. But what did you see there when it came to fashion?
Well, I found myself very delighted in a lot of ways by different regional fashions. And Iowa was just one place where I went where it kind of reaffirmed a idea that I had that the more organically people dressed according to their really authentic selves. Like in Iowa, there was a lot of people who were agricultural workers who dressed in really sort of kind of wonderful, very casual cowboy type garb, or there were old couples who you could tell it had sort of a sort of similar fashion code in their household for, you know, 50 plus years. I mean, sort of the more people resemble themselves in terms of their choices of fashion, the better they look, generally speaking. I mean, whether it's a 4-H T-shirt and, you know, old jeans and cowboy boots, or if it's, you know, some kind of elaborate drag queen style. I think the more closely people can see something organically true about the wearer, the more delightful their fashion is to the eye.
Well, when I think about the Midwest, I tend to think of people who kind of blend in a lot of the time. I'm sure there's exceptions. There's always exceptions of very fashionable people here in Wisconsin, of course. But a lot of Midwesterners I think of as wanting to blend in. And I remember this line about an East Coast writer commenting on Target shopping Midwesterners. So, I mean, if everyone dresses at Target, everyone shops at Target, everyone is going to kind of look the same. So what are we saying when our fashion choices make us sort of aggressively neutral?
Well, I think that there are, you know, I think that in the Midwest, people kind of are a lot like Canada in that they're sort of fancy averse, or, you know, they don't want to look too flashy or too overbearingly eccentric in some way. But I actually think that style, personal style, does not require you to shop somewhere other than Target. I mean, you can put together something totally magnificent if you have a Salvation Army and a Target in your neighborhood that will express who you are. And it's really about let yourself fly your own freak flag a little higher is sort of the message that I like to say in my book.
So how do we do that?
Well, I mean, give yourself a little bit more permission. I mean, my fashion evolution always came through exciting footwear. I think a lot of people have felt this way where when I was growing up and getting older and kind of exploring new personalities, it always started with boots. I would save lots of money and I would have certain boots in mind and save up for them. They would always be boots that were a lot cooler than I was. And then by wearing them, I would try to become that person.
We're talking to Cintra Wilson right now, author, performer, and former New York Times fashion critic. Her new book is called Fear and Clothing, Unbuckling American Style. And, you know, speaking of boots, you have a picture in the book of Condoleezza Rice wearing some super spiky heeled knee-high boots. What do you see in that particular fashion choice? This is a DC power player.
Well, that was a really remarkable fashion moment, I think, for American politics. I mean, Condoleezza Rice was, you know, our first very sort of flaring Secretary of State. And she, I thought, was kind of giving us a very sadomasochistic message with these extremely pointy, I believe they were Jimmy Choo, knee-high stiletto boots. And she was wearing it with kind of a a very long black Nehru jacket, and she was receiving some kind of award, but it was definitely a very powerful sort of proto-fascist fashion message. She looked like a really awesome dominatrix, which I think was probably a, you know, an extension of their general philosophy of American exceptionalism, but it looked great.
I mean, do you think she actually intentionally, or her stylist, I'm assuming she might have a stylist, do you think she actually intended any of the overlays you just said, or did she just think, oh, this looks pretty good, I'm going to wear it?
Well, there was enough commentary in the sort of blogosphere afterward. I mean, I think that Condé was probably very savvy about her fashion choices. She is a very, very intelligent woman, and I think that she was just having fun, pretty much, with her fashion choices and her, you know, her war diva status.
And what about Michelle Obama? You write about her in your book too, and she's seen as a big fashion icon these days. What are her choices say to you about who she is?
I think that Michelle Obama is a brilliant and beautiful fashion icon. I write in my book about her inaugural dress, which was a really incredible dress by Narciso Rodriguez, who's one of my favorite designers. And it was a very strange and very controversial dress that not everybody liked, but it kind of looked like a French maid costume that was covered with blood. And I thought that was a really fascinating potential semiotic statement for a new first lady, to wit, we are coming in to clean up your bloody mess. And I thought it was brilliant. I don't know if it was intentional or not, but I believe that she is brilliant enough to have some idea of what she was wearing.
Cintra, we leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Cintra Wilson, author, performer, and former New York Times fashion critic. The title of her new book is Fear and Clothing, Unbuckling American Style. Coming up, we'll talk to an editor at Discover Magazine about the Juno mission to Jupiter. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret's out this week. Coming up tonight at 7, it's Latino USA. Today, the show spends a day in a bodega in Washington Heights, New York City, home to one of the biggest Dominican populations in the United States. That's Latino USA tonight at 7. First, last night, the probe Juno started orbiting the solar system's biggest planet, Jupiter.
All stations on Juno Accord, we have the tone for burn cutoff on Delta B. Juno, welcome to Jupiter.
That was Mission Operations Center at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California, with cheers there from the staff. Scientists received the signal confirming Juno's success late last night. It took 5 years for the spacecraft to travel this far into the solar system. Juno has a $1.1 billion budget, and its principal investigator said this is the hardest thing NASA has ever done. Bill Andrews joins us now to talk about the Juno mission and what we might learn from it. He's a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Bill, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back.
Well, Bill, how excited were you to hear the news that Juno made orbit around Jupiter last night?
Well, I was pretty happy. I mean, it was a nice Independence Day. The weather kind of cooperated with us yesterday here in Wisconsin. And then to find out late at night that everything had gone almost eerily perfect. Everything was super precise, which is just the way NASA wants it. But you never know. There's all kinds of stuff that could have happened. So to know that the Juno probe got there and it entered the orbit exactly as they'd hoped and everything is perfect, and now we have a nice few months of orbits and observations and measurements and all of this good science coming up, it's a good time.
So this mission began 5 years ago. I gather the trip took 5 years to Jupiter. But now that Juno is there, what are the big questions that NASA is hoping that Juno will have answers for?
Well, a lot of it is just to learn more about Jupiter itself. I mean, it's the biggest planet in the solar system. It, I think if you don't count the sun, it has something like 60% of the mass of everything else. So it's got a lot of stuff, and yet we still don't really know all that much about it. It's got this very vibrant, interesting-looking atmosphere with all its swirls and bands and the great red spot down there. But they're also really thick, and it's hard to tell what's going on underneath them in the planet's deeper atmospheres. Scientists don't even know for sure if it has a solid core like a lot of the inner planets, like Earth and Venus and Mars, or if it might just be gas all the way down, more like the sun. So all kinds of stuff about what Jupiter is currently like, and hopefully by learning all the details about its structure and what makes it up now and studying its just unbelievably strong magnetosphere and the radiation belts around it and all this other weird stuff around the biggest planet, hope to learn not just about Jupiter's story but about the solar system story and where Jupiter formed in the early days of the solar system and what it might have taken away from some of the other planets or helped do to some of the other planets, and, you know, not just learn about the solar system but ultimately even other planets out around other stars.
That's a lot of stuff you just named there.
A lot of stuff.
For
one
mission. And
that's right.
Juno's going to be hanging out around the poles, you said. Or that's what I've read, that there's something specific about how close it is and where it's going to be in orbit. What do we know about why that matters?
Well, it's going to be taking this polar orbit, which is just kind of going from the North Pole to the South Pole and back up again, over and over as it maps the surface of the planet. And when I say surface, I mean the gaseous surface. There's no hard, like, landing areas that it can touch down on. And that's important because by taking this really close, just about 3,000 miles off of that gaseous surface, and staying so tight to the planet for a lot of its orbit, the Juno probe will be able to stay out of some of the worst radiation areas that are just a little bit farther out from the planet. So those can be really hazardous to the space probe, to any kind of electronics, can mess with it very severely. So by taking this tight, super close orbit, not only is it going to be some great views for the spacecraft and its cameras and everything, but it keeps it out of harm's way, too.
We're talking with Bill Andrews right now, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, and we're talking about the Juno probe, which is in orbit around Jupiter right now. And let's listen to a clip right now of Scott Bolton, Juno's principal investigator. Here he is talking about Jupiter's moons.
It's also representative of nature. This is how we look. That's a mini solar system. And so I think it's very, to me, it's very significant because we're finally able to see with real video, real pictures, this motion.
So Jupiter's moons, I know that the moons of Jupiter are intriguing, especially Europa. What are we hoping to find there?
Europa is a lot of people's favorite moon around Jupiter because it's one of the best places where there might possibly, sort of, maybe, I don't want to get people's hopes up, but there's a chance that there could be life there. The conditions, as far as we can tell, on Europa are favorable or at least possible for life to come up, maybe in some way, since there's water, there's a heat source, there's chemicals there. So that moon in particular has long been of potential interest to scientists and sci-fi nerds alike. The other moons, the other big famous moons that are in orbit around Jupiter, the so-called Galilean moons, which are the four biggest ones, including Europa, are just part of the iconic nature of the Jupiter, the Jovian system, that when Galileo first, the Italian scientist, Galileo Galilei, first looked through his telescope at Jupiter, he saw these four little, maybe tinier stars. He didn't know what they were at first, and he saw that they were going around Jupiter much the same way that Mercury and Venus seemed to be going around the sun. And it was that observation that helped him really realize that Jupiter is just another one of the planets in the solar system and that we must all be going around the sun. So there's a lot of history in those four, you know, the Galilean moons that we'll be learning more about how Jupiter interacts with them, with its giant magneto, with its radiation belts and all of its magnetical fields. And the other thing, though, that I just want to add is that this mission will really be extraordinarily focused on Jupiter, the planet, too. That there have been other probes that have gone to Jupiter. The Galileo probe about 20 years ago orbited Jupiter, and it really focused a lot on these other moons and learned a lot about them, but it left the main planet itself still kind of in mystery. So we're going to be focusing mostly on the planet itself this time.
I want to go back to something you said earlier about maybe possibly a slim shot at life on Europa. Mm-hmm. I mean, are we talking about microbes here? We're not talking about ET. What, is there any sort of expectation about what that life would be?
Well, I mean, again, any time that life comes up in a serious space science talk, you have to be so careful because you don't want to get people's hopes up. We don't know anything for sure. There haven't been any findings of any kind of life or evidence of it or anything. Just, it looks like maybe it's possible that life as we know it could exist there. So whether that takes the form of little microbes or maybe something akin to fish swimming in this giant moon-wide ocean underneath its icy surface, maybe something bigger, it's hard to say. Everything is speculation at this point. So we just know that it's possible maybe for life in some form to exist there.
So the ingredients,
that's very satisfying, right?
The ingredients are there. We just have to go look.
Exactly. And hopefully one day we'll be able to. This mission won't be able to shed too much light on that specific question.
Now, talking about what the planet might be composed of, it sounds like one interesting question might be hydrogen and possibly metallized hydrogen. Can you talk about how that could come into play?
Sure. Well, that, again, goes to the question of maybe what kind of core are we talking about that Jupiter might have. Already, we're able to tell that the vast bulk of Jupiter is hydrogen, and then the second fastest bulk is helium. Just like the rest of the universe at large, just like the sun, hydrogen and helium take up the biggest part. But it's possible with the huge pressures that we're talking about in the center of Jupiter that hydrogen can take on this form, the still theorized form of metallic hydrogen, which would be kind of a new thing. You can freeze the gas into a liquid, but so far on Earth, at least, we haven't been able to get it into this metallic form. So if they're able to find out that that is what's going on in Jupiter's center, it would be not just a boon for all that other stuff I said before about the planet and the solar system and everything else, but even just for the fundamental nature of one, the most fundamental element, hydrogen. It's just one proton in that nucleus, the first one. So even learning about the most basic stuff that makes up the rest of the universe here possibly at our fingertips by observing Jupiter.
Now, when will we start getting data, especially the good stuff that scientists are most excited about?
Right. Well, it's still going to be a little while because while it's in orbit around Jupiter right now, Juno is still kind of getting its bearings and will take about 53 days is what I've seen before it gets into its final orbit, which will be this nice tight, the polar one that will take just 14 days to go for one orbit. Right now, it's taking this big, longer one because it had to get out of the journey toward Jupiter in the first place, and you can't do that all at once. So for now, it's kind of looping way around in this extra exaggerated orbit that won't be super useful for observations. But it does have its cameras on. We have already been getting some images as it approached Jupiter, so we know the lens caps are off and things are working. And it looks like at the beginning of next month will be its next close approach to Jupiter, where it will be able to get some measurements. And then it'll be in October, I want to say mid-October, that it'll really be able to get in this tight orbit, really start jamming on all the science it can do.
We're talking to Bill Andrews right now from Discover Magazine, talking about the Juno mission, which just entered Jupiter's orbit last night. And we're taking your calls on this at 800-642-1234. Do you have any questions about the Juno mission? Were you watching it last night, waiting for Juno to make orbit around Jupiter? And are you interested in what NASA is up to? Do you want to see a NASA doing this and more? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue our conversation and get to your calls in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our discussion now about NASA's Juno mission to Jupiter with Bill Andrews of Discover Magazine. And we're taking your calls right now, too, at 800-642-1234. Were you watching this last night? And do you still care about exploring outer space? Is it still something that excites you and that you think the United States should be putting an effort into exploring the universe, getting data? And what are you most looking forward to seeing from the Juno mission and learning about Jupiter? Call us at 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Bill, one thing about this mission is that at the end of it, sounds like Juno will crash itself into the planet. Why is that?
Well, that actually ties back to what we were talking about earlier, and they just want to make sure that they can get rid of this probe and its possible earthly infectious contaminants without messing up any of the other moons, especially Europa. Should there be life on that moon? We don't want it to face any kind of hardships or trouble or anything just because some bugs from Earth happened to stow away on the probe and made their way to the moon. So the safest way to get rid of it, which is what NASA did for the Galileo probe 15 years ago-ish now, is just send it right into the planet itself and let it heat up and disappear inside the mists of Jupiter.
Hmm. You said it had been 15 years since Galileo. How has technology changed since then? Obviously, there's been a five-year lag while it traveled to Jupiter, but does Juno have technology that's going to give us better stuff than before?
Oh, definitely. I mean, we can just consider like the difference in consumer technology from the Galileo probe entered orbit around Jupiter in 1995. So if we consider, you know, what personal computers were like, what digital cameras were like, if anybody had any, you know, all that kind of just everyday tech compared to the things that we had in 2011 when we launched the Juno probe, already you can imagine all kinds of greater sophistication with the cameras, with the equipment, with the communications. NASA engineers had a few more years to practice getting the orbital mechanics right with other flyby missions that had gone near Jupiter, with all the other planetary missions that have been going on recently. So all this extra expertise, extra technology will be able to get us just the best view that we've ever had of not just Jupiter and its system and everything, but really being able to peer inside past its cloud tops into what's going on within Jupiter.
And you said we may even be able to get clues about the known universe and our own planet. What kinds of pieces of the puzzle are possible to pop up there?
Well, one of the main things that they're looking for in with the Juno probe at Jupiter now is to see how much water is in its atmosphere. And they already know that Jupiter has water in its atmosphere already, but now they'll be able to find out exactly how much and what kinds of concentrations of other elements, other stuff in the atmosphere there. And the whole point of that will be able to help the researchers and the theorists be able to figure out what part of the solar system Jupiter formed in. And if it's got all kinds of water, if it's got tons of water in its atmosphere, then the odds are Jupiter formed farther away from the sun where there were lots more, or from the nascent sun, I should say, where there was more ice and there was more colder stuff and water was more abundant. And if they don't find that stuff, then they can tell the opposite. Then Jupiter probably formed close to where the sun was forming, where things were hotter, less volatile stuff like those ices. So by being able to tell where in the solar system Jupiter likely formed, they can tell all kinds of other things about how it might have moved. They call it planetary migration throughout the solar system over the billions of years. Maybe it kicked out some other gas planets that we've never seen because they got kicked out, or what kind of role Jupiter might have played in possibly protecting the inner solar system from getting bombarded by too many asteroids and comets, with Jupiter's massive gravity being able to kind of fling them away and deflect them. So just all kinds of solar system insights by studying all this kind of stuff about Jupiter.
And Bill, as we wrap up, less than a minute to go here, but do you think that people are still engaged, still care about exploring the universe, care about NASA? We've dialed back, or NASA has dialed back manned space missions, and we have been sending unmanned spacecraft up, but is the enthusiasm still there?
Well, I might be a little biased because my personal enthusiasm is just so high, but I do feel like people just inherently like this stuff, and Hubble photos are always very popular when they, you know, they have these just beautiful images of a distant galaxy or a colorful nebula. Or I feel like among the sciences, astronomy and space stuff has to do a little bit less of the why this is cool kind of justification that a lot of, you know, bio stores, oh, well, this can help fight cancer, or chemistry stores, oh, new materials. You don't have to say that a lot with space stories. It's just this tells us about the universe. And, well, you're a part of the universe, and that's kind of neat. Everyone can look up at the night sky and see more or less what we're talking about. And if you've ever gotten the chance to see Saturn or Jupiter or a galaxy through a telescope, you can really feel that visceral just, there it is. And I feel like that kind of gut, visceral reaction to space is still something that people feel today. And
Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
That was Bill Andrews, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha, talking about Juno. The cost of healthcare has gotten a lot of attention recently, and it could get more scrutiny. Madison's mayor is asking the city council to approve a resolution looking at why hospital prices are different for the same treatment. Shemaine Mills reports.
If you have to go to the hospital and you want to get an idea how much you might pay, you can get an estimate. I'm paging through a list of the most common reasons someone might be in the hospital. Everything from heart failure to knee replacement. And there's different prices depending on how you pay. There's one column for Medicare and another for private insurance. Finally, there's what's known as the median charge, the so-called sticker price. All these numbers are different, and Paul Soglin wants to know why.
If you look at the column and go down every one of these items, you'll see the private insurance payment is almost twice of what is the payment for a Medicare patient.
Mayor Soglin's taking on the titans of healthcare at a time when the focus on hospitals has intensified. A study published in May in the journal Health Affairs zeroed in on hospital profits. Most of those with the biggest surpluses from patient care were nonprofit hospitals, and Gunderson Medical Center in La Crosse topped the list. The hospital disputes the study, which got national attention. Now there's another study, this one from Yale University, which has Soglin questioning whether those with private insurance are paying higher prices to subsidize low Medicare rates. The Wisconsin Hospital Association's Brian Potter says there is cost shifting.
The notion that Medicare pays less than the commercial market is not anything new.
But are patients with private insurance bearing just some or all of the burden of low Medicare rates? UW business professor Justin Seidner says most of the studies looking at cost shifting haven't found it to be the main driver behind increasing health costs.
Hospital networks typically are going to negotiate for the best price they can get from insurers, regardless of how many patients they're treating with Medicare.
It's not just Medicare pushing up prices. Seidner says the Yale study found research and teaching hospitals tended to have higher prices.
They also seem to have some higher indicators of quality. And so, you know, it may be a case where, to some extent, people are willing to pay more to have access to these high-quality research and teaching hospitals.
Soglin agrees, but thinks the disparity in hospital prices is more than that. He wants hospitals to reveal the actual cost of providing care so the city can determine if prices are too high. The Hospital Association has criticized the Yale study Soglin is using to support his claims. Yale economics professor Zach Cooper uses data from national insurers, not in the Madison market. Soglin says, so what?
Doesn't mean his conclusions are wrong. But one way we can find that out is if they would provide us with the rest of the data, which they won't do.
Some members of the Common Council characterize Soglin's proposal as mission impossible, potentially costly and complex. Soglin is undeterred.
It's my hope that if we act in this area that we can find other cities around the country who will join with us, other employers, in wanting an explanation and an answer to these, what I consider to be vast discrepancies in fairness.
A city committee deadlocked on the matter last week. Soglin had to break a tie to bring it to the full Common Council, where it will be debated tonight. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.